The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, September 22nd, the Don't Pee on My Leg edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. Joining me in the New York studios are June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah. Thank you for being so precise today.
Absolutely. And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
So our intrepid investigative listeners have tracked down the source of Swedish soap. That was kind of impressive. How many people knew all about the Swedish soap?
Yeah, or had like amazing detective skills. It was very impressive.
So where do we find Swedish soap?
Well, lots of places. Urban Outfitters, Amazon. I think I'll be ordering it from Amazon just because I'm a shortcut taker. But I was very glad because it wears down really quickly because it's so scorgy. Like, it just disappears.
I just love that word so much.
Scorgy. We're going to have like, we have to do a live show and there'll be just like glistening faces from the audience. All those scorgy, blemish-free fans.
For a minute, I thought you were anticipating us actually taking a shower with the Swedish soap live on stage.
Yeah. That's Slate Plus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very plus. That's XXX.
All right. Yes, that's the double XXX show, the triple X show. Okay, our three topics today. First, we're going to talk about trigger warnings on campus, all over the internet. What do we think of them? Second, race and representation. This is kind of a weird topic. It's a little meta. When we, the XX Gabfest, talk about a topic, we get a lot of complaints about why we don't have a representative of that race, sexual identity, nationality on the show. So we're actually going to discuss our process, how we choose and what we think about this. And finally, Judge Judy, her 20th anniversary, what makes her so immensely popular. And June, can you tell us about Slate Plus?
Yes. In our Slate Plus segment today, we'll be asking, are meetings sexist? If you want to hear that segment and get all the other benefits of being a member of Slate Plus, sign up for a free 2-week trial at slateplus.com/XX. Oh, and hey, everybody, we have a dedicated Twitter feed now. Please tweet to us at XXGabFest on Twitter.
Okay. Our first topic, trigger warnings. Before this fall college semester started, the University of Chicago Dean of Students, John Ellison, sent a letter to freshmen explaining, we do not support so-called trigger warnings, we do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial, and we do not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own. This is the quote that Katie Waldman begins her recent Slate piece with, that considers trigger warnings from a psychological and philosophical perspective. Okay, trigger warnings kind of began in the lady blogosphere. Yeah. I didn't know that was absolute. Like, I kind of knew that, but I don't think I absolutely knew that.
Yeah, you know? I figured they'd started like in academia and migrated to Tumblr, like so many things. Yeah. But it does seem like, according to Andy Zisler, who edited Bitch. She remembers seeing them in the comments of Ms. magazine in the late 90s, early aughts. And then when Feministing and all those magazines really took hold, that's when they really became dominant in a certain part of the lady blogosphere.
And I mean, there's always been, you know, a sort of a polite or a considerate, you know, giving of a heads up kind of thing. Like, I remember many years ago, a small movie, I think it was called Shane. It was called Shame. It was a sort of a play on Shane. It was about sexual assault. And, there were a lot of screenings for women, for feminists. And because it involves sexual assault, people would say at the beginning, I just want to give you a heads up that, you know, if this is something that you might find upsetting. It was just like I don't want you to be surprised by this. So there's been this informal way of just kind of telling people things, giving them a sense of what they can expect. But the whole concept of trigger warnings seems relatively new.
The phrase. I think the phrase is what's become controversial.
Yes, yes.
NPR, I believe, reported some stats that they'd surveyed something like 800 college professors across the country. And even though a very small percentage of colleges, maybe 1% or 2%, actually have policies, either in favor or against trigger warnings, like the University of Chicago, about half of the professors they'd surveyed said that they had given what amounted to trigger warnings. But when they talked about how they did that, it was just like, okay, heads up, mm-hmm. you might, you know, there's some violence in this It wasn't like trigger warning,
yeah,
colonialism, you know, which I think is the thing that people have gotten so upset about.
Do you think it's because it's written? So if it's written, it's necessarily more formal. Like June, what you described at the top of a play seems okay to me because a play is a very intimate experience. But, you know, and if it's and it's a pretty informal form of trigger warning. But is it the thing that's brought it into relief? Like it's written at the top of the piece. And as Amanda Marcotte once said, it seems a little performative. Mm-hmm. Like at some point it became a way of signaling your credentials in alliance with a certain movement or your kind of okayness that you were on the right side of the fence more than it became like just a casual heads up, you know?
It does seem like it has. They have been kind of put in tension with academic freedom. I mean, when you look at what the University of Chicago dean lumped together, he may said no trigger warnings, no disinviting people who we've invited to speak. And those two things seem very different. I mean, this, the one about not disinviting people is clearly a matter of academic freedom and freedom of speech and so on. So, yeah, I think there's a little bit, even there, there's a little bit of performance. I mean, the University of Chicago was signaling the kind of place that it is, just as, you know, the kind of thing that Amanda Marcotte was referring to, you know, it's a different kind of signaling. So there is a lot of subtext going on on all sides of this discussion, I think.
Now, what I loved about Katie's piece is that she did the work of disentangling intellectual safe spaces and emotional safe spaces and kind of everything that goes into this muddled conversation. So she begins the piece by analyzing from a psychological perspective, like, what is a trigger? You know, mm-hmm. This is a psychological mechanism. It's well studied. There's lots of PTSD literature. And she concludes that triggers are very real. They are a psychological thing that happens. There could be an object out there in your environment that triggers something for you. Like she says, for example, she's struggled with anorexia. And so the casual use of the word binge, I'm binge watching, I'm binge whatever, like it does kind of, you know, it can make your palms sweaty, like mm-hmm. It can bring up stuff for her. She mentions a friend whose father recently died of a heart attack. And when people are like, oh, my God, I'm having a heart attack about this, I'm having a heart attack about that. It like there are lots of triggers in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that did feel really powerful because I think that, you know, as we've been talking about this air of performativity that can be around trigger warnings, I think there's also many people I know question whether the response that people are claiming is real. They might deny that that's what they're doing, but they are. When you say, oh, trigger warnings are bullshit, what you're saying is, I don't care about your feelings, because they're kind of, on behalf of the person who's complaining, they are deciding whether this is a really serious response, a physical response, or just like, I'm a little uncomfortable with that. Like, they're making these calls about what another person is saying is happening to them. And somehow the fact that you say, no, look, it's science. This is a real thing. If, you know, this does something to your brain. It does something to your sweat glands. Somehow that reassures people who are, I think, suspicious that there's, you know, there's rigor here.
And yet, at the same time, what Katie describes for her and for her friend is not something that she felt prevents her from being able to get through and read the word binge,
right,
or, you know, to just go out in the world and talk to people about binge watching television or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So there are gradations of response, right?
Absolutely.
Like, so not everyone who, you know, is triggered, let's say, by a word, has PTSD. And
mm-hmm.
So I think that this most people actually have manageable responses to their triggers. And so that is where the sort of controversy comes in.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so this makes you uncomfortable. Should you shy away from it? And then the other interesting part of Katie's piece that I didn't really know before this was that the preeminent treatment for PTSD is essentially exposure therapy.
Right.
And you know, figuring out what your triggers are and figuring out how to deal with them so that you can sort of function in the world and not be afraid of them creeping up on you all the time.
Right. She had this great sort of image of a book that you have to get through this book to get through your trauma. And, you know, that otherwise you're going to keep jumping to that one place in the book. If you can't read all the way to the end, you will have a great deal of trouble recovering. At the same time, you know, a classroom may not be the best place to work out. Maybe the best place to, you know, work through this book and work through your trauma is with a, you know, psychiatric professional.
I mean, I was reading between the lines in Katie's essay and understanding that she was saying, okay, I'm establishing triggers are real. Mm-hmm. And then the next step is it's not society's role to protect you from them. The reason that we shouldn't protect you from them has nothing to do with free speech. It has to do with A, imagination. Are we restricting imagination mm-hmm. and people's imagination? And B, it's better for you not to avoid all triggers. Like, it's better for you to kind of read the entire book. I'm not being that articulate, but I understood hers as a powerful argument against trigger warnings. Am I reading too much into
it? No, I think you're right. I mean, I think another thing that came up in her piece is that if you put a trigger warning on something, it sort of it prescribes what is going to set someone off,
yeah.
and it almost gets you in a state of mind where you're ready to be alarmed, mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. know, which yeah. is a complicated thing.
I mean, I think, Hannah, yeah, I had that experience that you described. I saw that in Katie's piece, but I also did see it as not a like, hey, everyone, you're freaking out about trigger warnings. They're not that bad. Like, it's not quite that. That's a very crude description of a very nuanced piece. But I did think that she did a service of say, like, this is not utter bullshit, you guys, because there are a lot of people mm-hmm. who just like, that's just shit. And like, I don't know the youth of today. And there's an absolute
right.
rejection of it. And I think she kind of, you know, said, no, this is not nonsense. But it's a warning. It's not, you know, and may or may not have a place, but let's also not be confused about what it is and what it does for people.
And I think what bothers people is the idea that it would allow students to disengage with the yeah. world around them, to just sort of retreat. And then I do think that in my sort of measuring my own personal responses to when I hear about different trigger warnings, I think it's appropriate to warn when there is a graphic rape or assault mm-hmm. scene. Mm-hmm. Do I think that there needs to be a warning if there is colonialism portrayed in a book? I don't, because I don't think that, and I'm probably wrong in saying this, but I think most people in America, that it's certainly not true. There are people who have immigrated from places where the effects of colonialism are still felt, but I just think that you don't need to give a trigger warning for, like, reading a Rudyard Kipling book, you know? I think that colonialism is a complicated subject, the legacy of which we are still understanding, and that is exactly where you figure it out, you know, mm-hmm. and your own relationship to it.
Right. I mean, I like, in my head, the summary for Katie's piece was, your fears are real, face your fears.
Mm-hmm.
It's better to face them. Like, they're totally real. They're not bullshit. You're not a bunch of coddled little babies, mm-hmm. like the Atlantic magazine said. They are real. But it's better to face them than not. Like, it's like psychology also supports the process of your facing your fears. Like, if they're real and deep and constant, maybe not in an academic classroom.
Right, right.
But that an academic classroom is also not necessarily the right place to restrict them.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I was on this panel once about free speech and trigger warnings, and like, the examples are just insane. Like the one you just raised, Noreen, mm-hmm. like, you know, you can't include in packets of legal, like when they prepare students for mock trials, they can't include cases which have the N-word in them, even though that's the foundational case that established a kind of racist behavior that was then overturned. Like, there's, you know, you can come up with so many examples of people wanting to be protected from language.
Yeah. I mean, my instant response to that example is like, okay, it's good if this gets you mad. Like, maybe that'll like help you do something. Then again, I am not Black, obviously. And so I didn't grow up with that as, you know, something that I experienced, you know, as an insult in my life. So I don't have that context. I think the term is microaggressions. And that's a whole other thing, right? Do microaggressions add up to trauma? Some people argue yes. And then some mm-hmm. people think the sentence that I just said is appalling. Do microaggressions add up to trauma? I lose them at the word microaggressions.
I mean, I guess that ultimately comes to, I mean, that's why I thought Katie's piece was so good, that it's neither dismissive nor a complete, you know, swallowing of the entire, you know, Megillah from microaggressions to, you know, whatever. I tend to think in my sort of middle of the roadway that there's something to all of this, And that it's absolutely wrong to just dismiss it and say, oh, come on, grow up. It's very condescending, but that it's just as condescending to just accept all of it and just say, you know. And I think the idea that this is going to leave classrooms with like two books that they can discuss is utter nonsense. But at the same time, it, you know, it is the start of potentially closing the realm of, you know, possible things for discussion.
Mm-hmm. We've fallen in the wishy-washy middle.
We're so fallen in the wishy-washy middle.
Well, I maybe should have just talked about this, but I had a relative who was murdered a couple of years ago. And for at least a year after that, every time I heard language that related to gun violence, I like thought about it. And so this was right around the time that the trigger warning debate was happening. And so I became obsessed with just how English language is just so threaded through with references to guns. Anyway,
that is so interesting. I mean, you know, I was doing some reading about metaphors, and sometimes, like, there's this concept that some metaphors are kind of dead. They've been around in language for so long that you don't even notice that they are metaphors, you know. And then some are still alive, like you're still noticing the metaphor because they're relatively new. And it never occurred to me with trigger warnings. Like, it's one of those things that becomes so ubiquitous that you don't think that the word trigger is actually a gun word, and you totally forget about that until you're triggered. It becomes a trigger for you personally.
Yeah, and actually, all of the gun metaphors are super old. It's just like so baked into our culture. I don't know. I just thought about that a lot over the past couple of years.
And so would you ever then have the next thought, I wish people would stop? Like, would you ever write an essay saying people should stop using this word because it's a trigger?
No, I wouldn't. I would not.
Do you think it helped?
I wasn't there when this happened, so I don't have trauma from it. I'm just sad, you know. Mm-hmm. And like every time I hear, you know, I just feel sad every time I hear about gun violence or whatever.
Right.
And the only time that I had like a visceral physical reaction, I went to a play where in the third act, as sometimes happens, someone pulled a gun and shot someone, and I just like started weeping. There actually had been, I didn't realize this, there had been a trigger warning in the review. It said like unusually sensitive viewers may not like want to go. And I like totally breezed over that because I'm not unusually sensitive. It was, it was an actual trigger warning and in the, you know, Charles Isherwood review in the Times. Huh. Anyway.
That's a really interesting example. So given that it really did set something off in you, like, what do you make of that? So you cried, and did that do nothing for you? It was just a bad experience?
No.
Because the piece seemed to suggest, like, it might be cathartic, but maybe it wasn't cathartic at all. Maybe it was just, like, assaultive, you know? The experience of crying in the play, I mean.
Right. I don't know that I want to, like, package that as either assaultive or therapeutic. It's just, like, is a thing that happened. And again, like, I wasn't closely involved in the trauma. I'm, like, several concentric circles out. But I think, sure, like time, I'm going to say a cliche here, but time heals some wounds, you know, and like the farther you get from it, the less I think about the language. And I still think if I were in a theater and that had happened unexpectedly, maybe I would be upset, but it was just like on my mind in a way that it pulled it out. I don't know. It made me have a lot more sympathy for the idea of trigger warnings. Mm-hmm. I'll say that.
All right. Well, everyone check out Katie Waldman's article, The Trapdoor of Trigger Words. It is in Slate, and it is an unusually original take on this much discussed topic. Let's move on to our second topic, race and representation. But before we do that, let's hear from our sponsor. All right. Let's move on to our next topic, race and representation. So bear with us, listeners. This is going to be a difficult topic. This is the complaint that we at Double X get most consistently, and that's why we thought we should address it explicitly. Sometimes the complaint is broadly about diversity. I wish you guys had more diverse voices. Sometimes it's more specifically topic related. Like if you talk about burkinis. Why don't we have a French person on or a Muslim woman who actually wears a burkini or ditto on sexual identity or anything involving African-American women, say, or even Nate Parker? So this is our attempt to be more transparent. How do we make these decisions? What are our considerations? And in an ideal world, what should they be? So you have to be patient with us. Don't like just calm your judgy mind for a little bit as we. No, because already everyone's coming with. You can almost like feel the listening audience coming with the like, but they don't do this. And in that conversation, they did about this. They didn't do that. So we'll let's talk about the practical considerations first. Like sometimes it's just a matter of time. Like news happens fast. We're deciding topics a couple of days before or a day before we record. And sometimes we do reach out to people and like nobody comes back. So that's the practical thing.
And we also record early in the morning, which is great for all of our schedules, but not always for, let's say, calling up someone on the West Coast. You can't be like, hey, do you want to get up at 5:30 a.m. to talk to us? And, you know, even for people who are in New York, it's kind of a schlep to get to our studio. So we are already excusing ourselves.
That's okay. We're just going to have to be open about our willingness to excuse ourselves. I mean, I should say that I do feel really defensive and I'm trying not to be defensive. And, you know, this I think we also we should talk about the kind of show that it is and how we see the show that it, you know, this isn't Invisibilia. This isn't a show where we craft and hone and shape and, you know, retake 100 times. It's a conversation between us, three white women who are not and not completely the same type of white woman. But it's. So that's where we start, I think. It's a conversation where we're figuring things out. We're talking through things. We're trying to figure out what we think. We're trying to work out our response, our individual responses to things in the news or things in the media and the culture.
Mm-hmm. And we didn't pick this group because it was three white women. Yeah. I want to make that clear.
Exactly. We just thought, we want, you know, white women just don't get enough of a... No, that was not why we...
I mean, I think, like... The question at the heart of this for me is like diversity versus tokenism. Like, should we only be having black guests on when there's a subject that's about race? And then, like, or should we be just trying to include more guests in general, some of whom happen to be people of color? Is it in some way offensive to ask someone on who maybe hasn't even written about the Nate Parker case, but just like happens to be black and none of us are black? Like that is sort of an uncomfortable thing to do. Be like, hey, will you come like make us?
Will you provide cover for us?
Right. And
I hate that, I have to say, because it's like then it's so many things are wrong with that. It's like then you're assuming that that person represents all the views of whatever race identity on that topic. Like in the case of Nate Parker, I actually did email Roxane Gay because she had written an op-ed in the Times about it. A fantastic piece. She had something to say. She had a particular position. So it's like it seemed like a natural, you know, ask to make, you know, can you come and talk about this thing that you wrote as opposed to like, can you represent all black women on the topic of Nate Parker, which just doesn't feel right, you know?
Yeah. And I think that there are like circumstances where we've had guests on who have really. So, for instance, when we had Gillian Keenan on to talk about kink, like, frankly, that's not a world that I know a ton about. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure I would have or maybe even did say something offensive. But having someone there who was knowledgeable to walk us through it was really helpful. Mm-hmm. And so trying to figure out what those – and I think maybe we do have a blind spot where sometimes we think we can speak to race more than we actually can. Whereas we know
we
can't.
The drag queen conversation was another one where like that was a sort of dispatch from a world about the fights between drag queens and feminists, which I just it was a world, the language of which I didn't know as well as the guest knew. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So I think we have a tendency to ask people on when it's, for lack of a better word, a subculture that we're discussing. Whereas if it's something like race, I think that. For whatever reason, we feel like that is more a part of the broad, our national conversation about race, and that we are somewhat more equipped to handle it. That might be wrong. A lot of our listeners think that's incorrect. And sometimes I think we are wrong and we can do better. But but just know that we are thinking about it and weighing all of these questions.
Right.
So let me ask you guys this. In my mind, I make a distinction between, you know, the specific topic, like what's your obligation to invite someone on to talk about a specific topic, and the kind of broader area of diversity, which I think everybody has a responsibility, anybody with a platform and a voice has a responsibility to think about, right? Mm-hmm. Like just the big, broad area of, you know, like when I'm choosing interns, I think about this, just like giving people of, you know, different voices, different whatever, different perspectives, a kind of access into this public space that we own. So that to me is a different issue. Like, how do we address that? Do we do a good enough job of addressing that? I don't know.
I mean, there's this big problem at the center of everything, which is we are three white women. And I don't want to give up my job. I mean, that is something that is
such like, an entitled white
no,
lady, June.
It totally is. Like, that absolutely is. I mean, when you have privilege, you hold on to it and you're, you know, until your fingers are white. I mean, and that's a reality. So, you know, yeah, that's one of the key issues at the core of our show. But we also, you know, it's the hardest thing to say because it's like you can feel the sort of the eyes rolling around the world. But like, we're not the same, you know, two of us are immigrants. I'm a lesbian. I'm working class. We're different ages. We're, you know, actually Hannah's working class, although I think we both live in very different worlds than the ones we grew up in. You know, there are perspectives that we have that are, you know, we're not like three clones,
right?
You know, sitting in a room or in two rooms reflecting our clone views.
Right. I mean, I think, Hannah, to your larger point, I also think that the way to eventually make this better is to start with young people and figuring out how to get more young people of different kinds into journalism and like air their voices. And so, yeah, we can do that in a small way by maybe just like looking for pieces that are not written, say, by a New York Times or Atlantic reporter who is, you know, a middle-aged white person. And I think that we have tried to do that. I think we are always looking for topics that are maybe a little bit out of our purview. Mm-hmm. And ironically, that's when we get in trouble, is when we're, you know, like no one complains if it's, I mean, they do. People are annoyed if we just, you know, talk about the mommy wars ad nauseum. But, you know, when we want to talk about things that are outside of our own, you know, world. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that I hope makes the show interesting.
Yeah. Oh, hold on. I see Vera Lynn has her hand up.
All right, wait. So we're bringing our producer Vera Lynn in to talk about, because she used to be a listener, a Double X listener.
For a very long time, like the Jess Gross.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh, wow, cool.
I listened to it when I was in college because, you know, I was like trying to figure out my own feminism and what that means. And, you know, and I'll also say, when I've told people that I'm going to be producing Double X, I think like 75% of the time it's like, that's so white. I can't wait to see what you do with it.
And it's, oh my God, like, that's embarrassing. That's our rep.
No, but I mean, and what I say is that I have been listening to the Double X because it kind of gives me a perspective that's outside of my purview, outside of what all my friends and Twitter followers or Twitter people that I follow on Twitter are talking about. And, you know, like, I would never know the perspective of a white Jewish woman, Hannah, who's a mother. You know, I would never get that through my Twitter page. And so I think, you know, to the point of how to bring representation or different voices in, I think it's just about, like, even when picking topics, to go outside of whatever bubble you're in. Yeah. And this, I think, like, in order to get a different perspective, it's really just about, like, talking to people about it all the time. And even when it's not about race, like, maybe even just, like, even, like, Daniel sends out topics, right? So maybe, like, when you're thinking about topics, getting different people, because I think a lot of times we don't know what we don't know.
I do think that just the idea of looking in different places is a great idea.
Yeah.
It's weird to be like reduced to your identity. It's
exactly.
Like some people
exactly.
like it exactly. and some people don't like it. And in some moments it feels good and some moments it doesn't feel good. I was like, dang, white Jewish mother. That sounds bad.
Yeah, it is weird to be reduced to a set of adjectives, which again gets back to my like slight uncomfortability with having someone else on because of their set of adjectives, you know? But I guess that sometimes there is not, if you're, you just got to get over that and not worry.
But I mean, in June, in like queer land, people like to identify sometimes as a set of adjectives, right? Like it's comfortable. It's not comfortable for me. Maybe my adjectives aren't cool enough, right? Like white Jewish mom is not so cool. But like, you know, it's like queer world, like people like it. right? They like to wear the badge of adjectives, really.
Yeah, I mean, well, there are a lot of jokes by LGBTQ comedians that essentially end, "We just love labels." but I think also that it's a response to having been forced to hide your labels and to pretend that you own other labels. So it's, I think that's about the particular moment that we're in right now, that, you know, a few years ago, not that many at all, it would have been very difficult to own up to your labels. So
I also think that having June on, and June having a different set of labels than Hannah and I do, has pushed us to do different topics. And June is wonderful for a number of reasons, but also she brings a perspective to certain topics that we don't have. And so I think there is a lesson for us in that, you know, okay, so we've improved the show by, you know, we didn't bring June on because she's a lesbian, but it did. Like,
it was because of my outstanding beauty.
It was, right? it was just the beauty and also the accent, June. You have like the world's best radio voice. That's your adjective.
But that's what diversity does. Like, that's right, why exactly. It's beautiful. It makes your show better. It makes everything better. Like, right. You can't fool yourself. If we had a fourth person on who was a Black woman, like, we would have a different set of topics that mm-hmm. we wouldn't mm-hmm. be like, you, African-American woman, can you speak on? It wouldn't mm-hmm. be because of that. It right. would be because, you know, there would be different topics we'd consider. Just like our world would be bigger, basically, mm-hmm. is sure. what would happen.
Yeah. So let's just talk on a really just in terms of like when we have people on, like when we discuss books or movies or shows, we have someone on from that show. Sometimes when we discuss articles, we have the writer. Sometimes we don't. And sometimes that's about wanting to drill. You know, we read the article, we think, oh, my God, I've just got so many questions. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's like, no, we don't want to have to cushion, you know, some of our criticism. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all polite people. That can be tricky. Just even the very thought of having a guest is a kind of complicated thing. We like the chemistry of chatting together, and we don't always want to change that by introducing a fourth person.
Yeah. I do think it is especially complicated for our show as opposed to maybe some of the other Slate shows.
Yeah.
Because we do talk about somewhat personal topics,
yeah, yeah.
and identity politics is baked into our subject matter.
Yeah.
So I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah.
All right. So where do we conclude? Let's conclude. What's our responsibility here?
I mean, I guess for me, it's just like, please know that we're aware. We're aware of our limitations. We are, you know, we do think about this. Clearly, we haven't done enough, but we are. This is something we're committed to, and it's not. It's not, those aren't just words. Like, it's, I don't know, like, kind of have faith in us a little bit.
Yeah.
Is my ask.
We're not trying to be assholes.
No, we're not. We're really not. Sometimes we are, but we're not trying to be.
But also, we could make ourselves, we could work a little harder. We could, we could send more emails. You know, that's true. We could, you know. There's someone who's willing to get up at 5:30 a.m. on the West Coast.
To discuss Star Trek.
Yeah. All right. If anybody's out there who's willing to get up at 5:30 a.m., represent a different view about Star Trek, give us a call. Okay. Try harder. Let's move on to our third topic, Judge Judy. But before we do that, let's hear from our sponsor. So Judge Judy would really just be angry at the rest of our show because we just weren't pithy enough and we didn't like lay down the law on anything. Mm-mm. So we're going to try and like Judge Judy it up for this last thing. She is the most watched show on daytime television. June Thomas, Edith Thomas, Miriam Rosen, my mother, avid, loyal Judge Judy watchers. Judge Judy is 75 years old. She's like rich as shit now. That was amazing. She makes more money than Katy Perry, and she works 52 days a year. It was like the profiles are so funny because they like follow her from this. She was like a normal person for like 60 years and then suddenly became this huge celebrity with a house here and a house there. And she's still basically like a normal person, just dripping with money and with a private jet. It's weird to read the profiles of Judge Judy.
Do you think that's part of the appeal? Is that she's just like a wise-cracking, sharp, no-nonsense lady. And by being that, you too can have a private jet?
You know, I interviewed my mom last night about Judge Judy. I was like, why do you love Judge Judy? Because she loves Judge Judy. Mm. My mother loves Judge Judy, and Joan Rivers are like the pillars of her identity. Those are like the two people who she admires and wants to be. So she says to me, she's strong-minded. My dad's been ill, so I've been in New York a lot. I've been watching a ton of Judge Judy this week. She's strong-minded, and she's not afraid to express her opinion. She's not afraid people will sue her. That was kind of a cute clue for me. It's this weird thing, like this namby-pamby, we're going to sue you if you say anything wrong culture. Yeah. She's not in that camp. That was a little Donald Trump moment. What, my mom likes Donald Trump. She likes Judge Judy, probably for the same reason. Yeah. She's sure of herself. Most important thing, she entertains you. You watch it and you don't get bored. When you go through the day, all these other Judge Matthew, just this, they're boring and dry. And she hits you hard, is what she says. She gives truth in a soft world. Huh. Oh, and then my mom said, I would like to be her. Ooh. She knows how to maneuver around everybody and read you like an open book.
Huh. I definitely think when you told me that your mom liked Judge Judy, I did think that about how you told us that she also likes Donald Trump. It does seem like Judge Judy appears to be a full-on liberal, but there is a similarity in the sense that she doesn't care about, you know, political correctness, as Donald likes to mention. Like, it's about, I'm not going to be careful. I'm not going to be just kind of falling over myself, not to upset people. I'm just going to tell the truth, and I'm going to just give it to you right between the eyes, which, you know, she wouldn't have the kind of guilt I'm having about having said that. She would just like barrel on and just move to the next pithy quip.
Yeah, she's about moral correctness or something, also funniness.
Yes.
I love that she and Oprah are essentially set up as rivals. So at some point, she bested Oprah in the daytime ratings. And it's amazing because they really, like, their point of views on the world could not be more different, right? Like, Oprah is like, accept yourself, believe in the secret, and wear these cashmere sweatpants. And Judge Judy is like, pay the rent, don't piss on my leg, and tell me it's raining, you know? And I was thinking about this last night. Am I an Oprah or am I a Judge Judy? Mm-hmm. And I wish I were a Judge Judy. And I think I would be better at my job if I were a Judge Judy. But I think I'm an Oprah acolyte. Like, I want the cashmere sweatpants and I want to believe in the secret.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm aspirational, too. There is something about her willingness to, like, she gets paid like $45 million for 52 days a year. But it's not glamorous work. Mm-hmm. You know, every profile, we read some really good profiles, but there's a similarity to them because clearly that, like, her life is as it is. And she, like, plays, gin rummy between cases. And she doesn't have a glamorous dressing room. And she just kind of is very impatient. Like, there's clearly a way that she is. And it's not about, even though she has these gigantic houses and a lot of money, it's not about luxury and, you know, dripping jewels. It's about, like, just getting on with stuff.
Yeah, I loved all those profiles because I guess I just didn't know that much about her. I sort of assume all TV is fake and court TV in particular. But she really, like, did this in family court in Manhattan for years. Yeah. And she was actually discovered through a profile that was written in the Los Angeles Times that really it's describing her in actual, you know, Manhattan court. And it sounds like a transcript from a Judge Judy episode. Mm-hmm. She was just acting this way for years, and she kind of developed a reputation because most judges don't talk that way. Mm-hmm. But she sort of laid out her philosophy, which is that, you know, you have to be quick because there is such a backlog of cases, and you should speak in English and, like, you know, like not legalese, so that the people in court get what you're telling them. And I kind of love that.
Right.
But what is – I feel it's very cynical. I have a hard time watching Judge Judy with my mom because it's essentially these, like, sad sacks, right? Like, it's poor people, basically. It's poor people. They're arguing over $30. You stole my wallet. It had $50 in it. You know, you took my mattress and my mattress cost $65 or whatever. And she gives them back a kind of just brute moral clarity. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess – In that LA Times profile, what she was saying is, like, here's just like a wash of this sad sack world, and basically nobody cares. Like, it happens behind closed doors. These mm-hmm. judges don't care. Nobody cares. And so I guess what she's saying is, I care enough to, like, be blunt and tell the truth to these people. Mm-hmm. But it just feels like exploitative and cruel to me. Like, what bit of hope did she leave them with? Like, did she leave them with moral clarity? I don't know. At some point, it tips into the just kind of bullying and cruel.
So you're an Oprah too.
Yeah.
I guess I'm an Oprah. I just can't stand it. It's like they sit there. They all look the same. They have like ill-fitting suits. They're trying to speak in a kind of, you know, formal legalese. And they just get all lost in the details of their crud and whatever is happening in the crud of their, you know, of their life. And then she just kind of comes from on high and like whacks them in the head.
At the same time, I mean, yeah, I think all reality television, in a sense, is exploitive. I mean, you're exploiting people's lives and you're not really paying them that much. One of the things that we read talked about the kind of the secret of Judge Judy and other shows like it, which is that, you know, they essentially troll the nation's, you know, dockets for cases that they think might be suitable. They have to be civil cases. It's essentially small claims court, and Judge Judy is binding arbitration. And then if a judgment is made against someone, say, you know, you owe her $500, they'll pay, the producers of the show will pay that $500. Because my question has always been, why would you do this? Why would you be on this show? You know, and yeah, they want to be on TV. You get a trip to LA, you get your flight, you get your hotel, you get food. And if you are the person being sued, you will get your judgment taken care of. And so in a way, yes, they do look sad. They do look stressed. But I don't know that it's that much stressful than court. And they're not going to get anything on their records. I kind of see it as it's one of those positive alternatives to our pretty shitty criminal justice system.
Judge Judy is the positive alternative to
that. Yes.
I think there's something interesting in the idea that we want to watch a moral arbiter at work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're a kid, the teacher tells you what's right and wrong. Maybe you go to some kind of Sunday school and that person tells you what's right and wrong. But as an adult, that's not really enforced that much. You have all of these moral quandaries or arguments all the time, and no one steps in and says, you're right, you're wrong. And I think that's the pleasure for people in watching Judge Judy, is like, we all decide things in our mind, but here's a person. Like, I think it is the sort of on high, God-like, you know, authority that people like to watch. And often I think people get pleasure from agreeing with her and not the sort of screwed up people arguing.
Well, you know, I think the people, generally speaking, who watch the show are people in similar circumstances to the people whose cases are being processed. And I think there is actually a usefulness in having someone say, like, when you have no money is when you are most likely to do something that could get you in trouble. Not because you're a bad person, but because you got no damn money and you're stressed and kind of desperate. Mm-hmm. And when, even if it's someone who is, you know, a little bit of a two-dimensional character, says things like, if it's too good to be true, if it looks too good to be true, it's probably too good to be true. Or if a guy's grandmother kicks him out of the house, there's probably something wrong with him. Like, these things, which just seem like, in a way, are statements of the obvious, are actually pretty useful. You know, Verilyn yesterday was telling me that you can also use Judge Judy to provide cover. You say, look, you know, roommate, you seem like a really good person. I don't want to, you know, if it was just me, I wouldn't want anything down on paper. But Judge Judy says, I really should get something in writing. So would you mind just signing this?
That's amazing. Because who doesn't trust the authority of Judge Judy?
Why?
Like,
I
don't even really watch Judge Judy. Like, I have watched Judge Judy, but it's not like a big part of my life, you know, and it never sort of has been. And yet I still revere Judge Judy. Like, if someone said, like, President Obama has said, who doesn't love Judge Judy? That's kind of the way America feels about Judge Judy, except for Hannah.
Well, love is a bit of a strong word. Like, also, my mom is kind of like Judge Judy. Like, she does go around and, like, she is a kind of moral arbiter, and she is very blunt and in people's faces. So maybe that's why it has a little bit of a charge for me that it might not for the rest of America. It's just like, I'm a little bit afraid of Judge Judy, as much as I love her.
My mom is very Oprah-ish, to be honest.
Yeah.
My mom's somewhere in between. You know, it is, though, I think, relevant that Judge Judy airs in 125 overseas markets. Mm. You know, my mom, I think, sincerely gets her view of America from Judge Judy more than she gets it from me. Like, so if I'm saying something that really doesn't have an analog in Britain, like, oh, I've got to do my taxes, which, I don't know, in Britain, it's just it doesn't work that way. Like, she knows what that means because she's seen it on Judge Judy, and she'll be like, oh, tax refund. Oh, okay, yeah, I see that on Judge Judy. Like,
what are you going to buy with it?
Yeah, exactly. You're going to pay off that car that you took from that guy? I mean, you know. So it is amazing how much this is a vision of America for a not tiny number of people around the world.
And it might be more realistic than other shows, like, yeah, you know, take a massive international export like Dallas, right? You know, this is actually Judge Judy is more realistic portrayal of what a lot of people in America live like. And it's like a tiny mini soap opera. That's the other thing. It's like every case is like a teeny mini little reality soap opera. And you can just like fill in the rest of the details of the boyfriend and girlfriend who were like in love and now they hate each other and she stole his truck or whatever. Like, you can just fill in the rest of the picture.
Yeah, everyone has a soapy story in their life. It's kind of great to have that aired.
Well, and sometimes I only watch when I'm at home in England, but I watched a couple of episodes on Monday. And something happened where, like, if this case that was being described had been an episode of, say, Law and Order, I would have yelled out, they stole that truck. But, like... And Judge Judy said, you know, essentially just jumped to the conclusion, you know, surely after many years of experience in, you know, courtroom situations, that there was fraud involved there. And she didn't go through all the motions. She didn't do any findings. Mm-hmm. It's not real court. But she kind of knew what was going on, just like we know what's going on, you know, in our sort of cynical, suspicious responses to things. And she just blurted out, none of this findings and evidence and all that. Just, yeah. You stole that, didn't you?
All right. Well, listeners, you have any experience with Judge Judy, hate her, love her, have a mom who's obsessed with her like June and I do, please write in and tell us your Judge Judy stories. All right. Recommendations. June, which soap do you have for us today? Which Danish soap?
Yes. I would like to recommend the national soap of Tajikistan. In Tajik, it's called... No, okay. Actually, I'm going to recommend a show that really doesn't have very many, and sometimes none at all, women in it. But I've really gotten into it, and I watch it every night anyway. It's an old British sort of cozy-ish mystery that's available on Netflix called George Gently, or sometimes it's listed as Inspector George Gently. And it's, you know, your basic British procedural, police procedural. But it's set in the 60s. And so in the way that British shows often do, it really kind of reflects on social issues of today by kind of comparing them somewhat subtly with how things used to be and how much things have changed. And there is a very nice chemistry between the two main detectives. The sergeant he has, you know, long mop-top hair and he's got some really weird attitudes. And so we kind of, you know... We viewers also find ourselves arguing with some of his appalling views. But it's really, really watchable. And as so often happens with British shows, some really great actors just show up randomly. And you're like, oh, my God, there's. And so that's really fun. George Gently.
Great. I am going to recommend Jonathan Safran Foer's new book, Here I Am, which I am currently reading, which is an amazing book about a marriage that is or isn't falling apart. It's kind of fractured, told in texts and kind of biblical exegesis. It's also about the destruction of Israel. It's a very, very interesting novel in which I feel like all the big questions of life, kind of how they seep into the day-to-day. And he does a great job of portraying the wife, I would say. Okay, Noreen, what do you got?
I want to recommend a movie, The Meddler, which was out earlier this summer. Did either of you guys see it?
Yes,
I did not.
It's now like on video on demand. You can rent it on Amazon or whatever. It's just a delight. It stars Susan Sarandon and Rose Byrne. And Susan Sarandon is a widow who has moved across the country to be nearer to her daughter, who's like a, you know, screenwriter, showrunner type in L.A., and very depressed about both a breakup and I think still her father's death. And Susan Sarandon just does an amazing job portraying this meddling mother who calls her daughter 8 times a day, and the daughter keeps putting her off. And so slowly throughout the course of the movie, she finds other places to put her excess energy and love. She sort of adopts an Apple Store genius after he is really great at fixing her
iPhone.
And she's like, you should go to law school. And she drives him all, you know, to night school. Anyway, it's just really sweet and funny. And I think it didn't get a lot of attention. And I wish it had because I loved it.
Yeah. It's the kind of movie that a few years ago would have been like that classic art house movie. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't exist anymore. And so I think we don't really know what to do with it. But I agree. It was really wonderful.
Yeah. So good.
That movie is speaking to me.
Oh, yeah. You should see it, Hannah. Like, absolutely.
Maybe I'll even watch it with my mom. All right. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks to our producer, Verilyn Williams, for coming on and making a cameo in today's show and also for producing This Week and Every Week. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lickteig. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. And our intern, our wonderful intern, is Daniel Schrader. Thank you, Daniel. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page to learn more about the show and our recommendations is at slate.com/xx. Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest. Let us know what you want us to talk about and what you thought about the show, or you can email us at XXGabFest@slate.com. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever people listen to podcasts. Leave a comment so more people can learn about the show. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.